Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Yeah, I can hear you. You hanging up? I keep the calls keep dropping. You're on live on the other phone. Yeah, it's a terrible connection, but we're on live. Can you call back any other number?
Sure, I'll try it again.
All right.
I can't hear anything. I just want to call in. I can't hear you.
Okay.
Hello? Hello?
I can hear you loud and clear, Mr. Dukes. Can you hear me?
Now I can.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome to the show. We got you now.
All right. Thank you.
Well, good. Thank you for taking time out to join us. I know, you know, you're a very, very busy guy. I was definitely telling our listeners a little bit about you, but I'm glad you're here. You can tell us about yourself. We know that you came from Canada to L.A. in the 60s?
Yes, that's correct. My parents immigrated from Canada. They themselves were immigrants from Austria, Hungary, and Israel. They were refugees from Europe during World War II. Both escaped the Holocaust. My father ended up joining the Haganah and later a special unit for the British Armed Forces, and my mother miraculously escaped the camps and lived in Hungary up until the end of the war, where she immigrated to England, was a nanny for a while, went back to Israel. That's where she met my father. And he was repatriated back into the service, intelligence services, went back to Europe with my mom. As you can imagine, it's the 1950s, the height of the Cold War. I think his cover was blown, and then they sent him to Canada, where I was born, along with my brother, Stephen. So, and it was a struggle. It was a struggle.
So when you moved to California, was it the San Fernando Valley area? Is that it?
Yeah, I actually moved. Originally, we were in the Fairfax district, and then because my father was working in Pacoima, it was easier for us to move to the valley for him to commute to work and back. So we ended up in the San Fernando Valley, and I was very blessed because that was an era when it was called the Valley of the Champions. You had Black Belt Magazine, Tai Kung Fu. They were all within a couple of miles of each other. You had all the major martial artists in the world, or celebrity martial artists, I should say, in the world, all living within, you know, a 20-mile radius of each other and schools of each other. And so it was very easy to go from one school to the next and see the greatest champions of all time, from Bruce Lee to Dan Asano, Ed Parker, Chuck Norris, S.B. Moon, Bong Soo-han, just to name some of the names, Bob Osmond. I mean, these all were legends in that era. Steve Fisher was just over the hill. He was another great legend, responsible for training Mike Stone. So, you know, anybody who knows anything about sport karate knows these names of that era, the 1960s and 70s, which was the golden era of sport karate.
What got you interested in the sport, martial arts?
Well, being the fact that we were impoverished, I couldn't play football, even though I was probably the star player in my junior high school. I couldn't afford shoes, and we were too proud. I was too proud to ask for help, and I couldn't afford the helmet and the shoulder pad deposit. And when I walk home from school or look at things, I noticed that all the martial artists, they did their sport without shoes on, and so that's kind of what I got into. And it was based out of necessity at first, and then I developed a real love for it. I don't have that racist lineage line, and that's what I really hate about martial arts today. They all promote this lineage thing, but what people don't understand is lineage is really about racism. It has nothing to do with skill sets or anything else. It has to do with, you know, class warfare, you know, because the samurai were a certain class, and if you weren't part of that class, then guess what? You didn't count. You know what I mean? And so, they try to introduce that in martial arts for the longest time, especially around, you know, lies like ninjutsu is a martial art, which it's not. I mean, to this day, most people think ninjas were separate from samurai. They're actually one and the same. And history books and all the real academic literature out there from the era proves it. I was one of the few people who was a voice about that and protested it. And because I didn't want to mislead people, I believe in ninjutsu's principles. It's actually a philosophy. It's not a physical martial art. It's an actual philosophy that was very much like Bruce Lee, use what works, unorthodox warfare. And outlined a certain way of approaching tactics and strategy. And, and that's why I called my system Duke's Ru or Duke's Ninjutsu. I never pretended to be some 16th century martial art, you know.
Right.
Unlike my, people who've actually amassed a fortune deluding the public and fleecing them by selling this lie that ninjas were the separate equal society and they were freedom fighters. And to agree, there's a history point where there were ninja families and they were aligned with, they were independently, you know, free of warlords, if you want to call it that, certain section of Japan. But this whole idea of Koga versus Iga, it's all BS. I mean, it's they're all one and the same. And in fact, there's treaties in the 17th century that prove it between the different groups where they agree to cooperate with each other. So I've got a book coming out, Ninjas Are Bravo Sierra, or for those who don't know what Bravo Sierra means, it's bullshit. and that's the title of the book, really, is Ninjas Are Bullshit. And it's really about the manipulation of perception, racketeering, and racism in the martial arts industry, and how that's sort of a microcosm of to look at if you have such an industry that's so honorable and so disciplined, what's going on in other industries possibly when this itself has been affected and what we're doing. And we're going down, I think, a dangerous path with these, you know, monopoly media, mass media companies, whereas in the past to protect our freedoms, you know, someone couldn't own more than 45 radio station and TV stations, you know, in the country. Now, you can own thousands, and we see what's going on. Our country's getting raped, you know, how the laws are changing and big business, or we're slowly not becoming a free society, you know, and I'm a constitutionalist, you know. And I really am strong about the Constitution and our rights under the Bill of Rights, and I'm a champion for that. I took an oath, and I protected our country for years, and it to me, it's a betrayal how some people are just basically not seeing the principle of things, just always seeing the short-sighted goal of things, you know.
Well,
you know, especially
amazing.
CEOs, you know. Yeah.
Well,
so,
well,
I mean,
I
one
think
of the things that you... Yeah.
I was just I think one of the problems is the people, you know, because the people, you know, they elect these people in the offices, and half of them don't even know.
Well, first of all, elections. first of all, the idea that we elect anybody is a facade. That's baloney. You don't elect anybody. We don't elect them. You have electronic controlling. They've already proved that the controls, the electronic vote tables can be controlled and altered. In order to be elected and run, you have to have certain polling groups, petition groups in place so you can be even elected. And it's just the big two, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats, to basically say who's who. And they're, in essence, one and the same today. You know, we see and hear these things about partisan politics and how they're against each other. But the truth of the matter is, it's the guys paying the bills. You know, a congressman gets elected, he's got maybe 6 months of work in office, and the rest of the time he's got to spend, you know, drumming up money for his reelection. You know, and it's ridiculous. You know, it's ridiculous. And that money for his reelection doesn't come without favors. And now we're being told that a corporation is a person that actually has person rights. So, you know, and that's the U.S., you know. But here's the thing. I still wouldn't trade it for any other country on the planet. I'm a very proud American, and I believe in the system, and I think it'll always correct itself. I just believe in the natural order of the universe, and eventually it always corrects itself. Maybe not in our lifetime, but it will correct itself.
Yeah. Well, we definitely gonna keep praying for that and hope we can get to see some changes in our lifetime anyway. But
yeah, well, see, that's what warriorship's all about, and what martial arts is really all about. It's about putting yourself out there, and this is what people understand, to serve the higher good. There's a quote I like to use, and it's called Tulikard. Tulikard means it's Celtic. It means to take the higher path, the harder path taken, to do the right or wrong, the right or right, as opposed to take the right or wrong. And that's how I live my life, and I've been very successful as a result of that, and very blessed. I mean, there's many times my enemies have come very close to my destruction. Both physically, economically, spiritually, emotionally, and that principle is the only thing that's really kept me going and actually saved me and spared me. And that, if I can share anything with your audience tonight, it's just don't be afraid. Take the high road. Just keep going down the high road, even though we have all this negativity trying to bring you down to their level. Don't think you fight fire with fire. Fire with fire just makes more fire. You fight fire with by taking the air out of it, or by, you know, being cool, you know, and that's the reality of how life works.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Question for you, Frank. Who taught you and motivated you in your early stages of your interest?
You know, it's not any one person. I think it was the idea of what makes you a man, you know. And I was very fortunate. I come from an era where people had a lot of foresight, especially around how children are influenced, and they would send you these messages. It'd be everything from what Disney would say in some of their movies, to John Wayne, to Humphrey Bogart, to, you know, it was just a different era. You had positive role models, whereas who really were about sacrifice and taking the higher road. Today's role models, I really feel sorry for a lot of these kids. I think they're being set up for failure. I mean, the role models are all based on antisocial behavior, shock and awe antics. You know, it's all about self-indulgence and hedonism. Well, what happens to every hedonistic society? It falls. It crumbles. That's what happened with the Romans. People forget the Romans were about, you know, had a lot of, you know, principles when they first started out, along with the Greeks. That's where we get democracy from. But when they became hedonistic, when the society, started dividing itself by set classes where it was just the rich and the poor and no middle class, it collapsed. And every society that does it, it will collapse. You know, it doesn't work. It's not how nature is. Nature's always going to be about balance. You know, So you can have your extreme poor on one side and you have your extreme rich on the other side, and you have something in the middle that balances it out. But if you have only the extreme rich and only the extreme poor, well, it's only a matter of time before those tables turn. And the very rich end up either dead, like in, you know, the French Revolution, you know, and you have anarchy.
Well, how do you find balance in all of this?
Prayer, belief in a force beyond myself and understanding. For me, I just surrender to what I feel is something out there that really guides my life. And if I choose to take the higher road, as my fiance tells me, things always seem to work out better. You know?
Well, I think
that's what it's all about, being good to each other. You know, rather than be angry with each other and be mean spirit, just give people back love. That's almost what I've done. I've had many people hurt me in my life, and people don't understand why I've never turned around and been vengeful or hurt somebody or been vindictive. And there's a difference between being vindictive and vengeful or seeking justice, you know, or holding somebody accountable. And even sometimes that won't work because the odds are always stacked against you. Like me with Van Damme, the trial was fixed against me. It was very obvious from the get-go, and the judge wouldn't even allow our contracts into evidence. I mean, come on, who ever heard of such a thing? But the thing that I always say is just you just got to take that higher road. And if you don't allow those things to affect you, you live one a happier life. You don't give your power over to them, and that's what warriorship's about. That's true study of martial arts. Isn't about conquering the person outside of you. It's about conquering yourself. That's the real study of martial arts, of military arts, military discipline. Is what it really is about. First, you've got to conquer and be in charge of yourself. Then you can use that ability to thwart off those other forces against you.
Isn't that the part that the American society have forgot about? They're getting more into, I guess, the actual fighting part of it opposed to the philosophy.
Well, I think there's a certain amount of barbarism, but here's the thing. They aren't very good fighters. Force on force only works when you're dealing with someone who is dealing back with it. Someone who knows how to redirect force will destroy you every moment. And that's what real martial arts is about, is how to redirect your opponent's force against them, you know, or in your favor. Not always against them, but just where it's in your favor, where you can take a situation and manipulate it to where it could even be a mutual outcome, you know, mutual benefit for everybody involved. And that's where real martial arts study, it becomes transformative. It's not about me kicking the next guy's ass physically, it's about me kicking the next guy's ass spiritually. How do I break his spirit to where he doesn't come back and attack me again? How do I break the spirit to maybe put him on the right path? And a good example of that is us with Japan. We broke Japan's spirit to be an enemy. Now they're one of our greatest allies.
Redirection
is part of it. And it's redirecting an opponent's energy and attention away from something else. You know, it could even be called misdirection in some cases when you're using deception. But the real thing about winning anything in life is you've got to show people where there's a mutual benefit, providing you're dealing with a sane person, or sometimes you're dealing with the insane, and that has to be eliminated. It's just like a cancer; it's just got to go. And that's where the death part comes in, unfortunately, in martial arts. If I'm dealing with a guy and he is so determined to take my life no matter what, or he's someone who's just filled with that kind of hatred that there's no reasoning, there's no correcting, then you're obligated to take that person's life because he will prey upon the next person and the next person and the next person. He's a cancer. Good example, like a serial killer. You know?
No, I just finna ask you, what are the different martial art forms do you practice?
Well, I don't practice any formal style because I find them restrictive. I do, however, embrace all martial arts. I think every one of them has something to offer, but I look at them from the standpoint of body biomechanics. Teach, and what Duke's Rue is about is where I really, through my years of study, and maybe because I wasn't influenced or, you know, propagandized to think a certain way, I really discovered that there's only 12 angles of attack and there's only 12 angles of evasion that will produce the unguarded moment in the opponent. What I mean by that is if I know if I can hit, if a guy is attacking me one way or a certain line of angle of attack, if I change the axis of my body to match an angle of evasion, I can hit him and there's nothing he can do about it. He can't get out of the way of the hit. And we've proven it with my students who have one-second knockouts on the internet. I think I my records speak for itself. And U.S. Special Forces are now using my method, and it's been a real game changer to the point that if you try to teach my method in a civilian population, you go to jail.
Question, Frank.
And that's, of course, not every country in the world, but in some countries, that's what it is.
Right. How different is your style than what Bruce Lee used, his style?
Well, Bruce Lee was still about free flow. He still taught, like, if a guy does this, you do this, or you do this, you do that. And he was a great mentor for me in that respect. Bruce Lee really was teaching the methods of, I think, of Miyamoto Musashi. He was about flowing and knowing how to flow and adapt. And he was about adaptation and using what's eclectic, what works for you. But the difference is I have an actual science behind what I do. I know why things work and when they don't work. It's not any form of guesswork. You know, I guess I took it to the next evolutionary step. And who knows, Lee might have found that hit on his own had he lived long enough. I really believe he was headed in that direction. And I used what he taught from the books I read and people I've talked to. People actually knew him and knew his philosophy, and people who defeated him in different things, like Vic Moore, to figure out where things broke down, to figure out, okay, how do I become better? What is the science of fighting? Nobody's actually taken the time out to figure it out. I did. And that's why I said I came up with the 12 angles of attack, 12 angles of evasion, the unguarded moment, kind of thing called the triangle of force. And when you understand all those principles, it becomes very easy to create a style for yourself that suits you based on your own personal experiences, based on your own personal instincts, based on your personal body biomechanics, which are all unique to each one of us. I mean, look at boxing world. Alberto Duran didn't fight like Sugar Ray Leonard. You want a total matchup. Here's the two great boxers. Didn't happen. Floyd Mayweather, he's got his own unique style. Does he fight like Muhammad Ali? No.
Oh.
Frazier. Yet they're all boxers. Okay, and we're just talking about just using hands now. We're not talking about like MMA where you've got feet and hands and you know, at work.
Elbow.
And submission holds. Yeah, which is even a wider spectrum of tools that you can use. So, You that's why these practice techniques, you take them to the ring or real fight, they just don't work. They'll never work because here's the reality. There's too many variables. You may out of 1 out of 100 times or 200 times, might be able to pull certain things. Now, there's certain things you can do, certain maneuvers, like certain joint locks, you know, combinations you can throw, all those kind of things. Yes, you can reproduce the result. Okay? Definitely reproduce the result. But you understand why you're reproducing the result. And most people, if you ask them, why is that happening, they can't tell you. They just know that if they do this and this, the guy kind of moves this way and you can set him up. Well, how is it? Why is he being set up? What's he doing? How's his body reacting? You know? And I get to him and say, well, that's because you're changing his triangle of force. And when you understand that principle and you apply it, it becomes so easy to see what a person's going to do. You can just catch them right mid strike and knock them out, you know, take them out of the game very quickly, especially when it comes to use of weapons. And the same thing holds true if I'm using even a projectile weapon. It's all based on, you know, projectile weapons are all based on linear movement, you know, because the round only goes one straight. That's it. I haven't yet seen a bullet that kind of curves yet, you know. You can shoot it and make a curve. So, it's again, it's all based on that linear. And you can even take the same tactics of stepping out and shooting the guy as he's shooting you, and you catch him, but he doesn't catch you. And that's in gunfighting. And just to give you an idea. So you can take the tactics you use in the ring or tactics and use that in gunfighting. You can take it, use it in knife fighting. You can use it in business. You know, your opponent coming straight at you, what do you do? You know, hostile takeover. They're running at you, trying to buy stock. What do you do? Maybe you step out and take some of theirs out the back end, you know, if you've got the ability to do it.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Got another. Yep, totally. Got another question for you, Frank. I know the movie Bloodsport, I know that was when a lot of people first heard about Frank Dukes. How did that come about with Jean-Claude Van Damme?
Well, actually, people heard about me before Bloodsport. Just Bloodsport kind of made me international, gave me international recognition. The interesting thing about Bloodsport is it's really kind of a, how do I say, prize for me, because I had been blacklisted prior to that. I appeared in Black Belt magazine 3 months in a row, and again, because I wouldn't go along with this, you know, consumer fraud of ninjas, you know, I was blacklisted. You know, the other people tell me that, you know, the reason I was blacklisted is because on top of that, I was Jewish. They found out I was Jewish, and if you look at Black Belt magazine, there's never a, you know, a Jew or a black person, a person of, you know, African-American descent is on the cover of that magazine. Just go through it. Why is that? You say they weren't dominant in the martial arts? That's ridiculous. You see my point? It's because
yes.
They were pushing a stereotype, and Black Belt magazine had an agenda, and the agenda was they didn't think it would sell to their consumers. So they just kept it with their stereotype, the Oriental being superior to the non-Oriental. That's what it was all about. And they had all these secret masters and all the secret information, da-da-da-da. Bunch of hogwash, you know what I mean? You know, and that was it. I mean, Bruce Lee became more popular after he was dead than he was alive. You know, because they kept pushing the image of who Bruce Lee was, the image of that he created on screen, that screen persona. And, you know, he only had 5 years of martial arts training. People don't realize that. And to me, some people say, oh, that's, you know, shocking. But to me, it was very inspirational because for me, when I became champion, all I had was 5 years of martial arts training as well. Same thing. And I didn't have it in any one person, just like Lee. I had it from a variety of different people. And I was eclectic in my thoughts the way he was. And he was free-flowing. So there's a lot to it. I didn't agree with him, though, tearing down the classical martial arts and him calling it the classical mess and all that. I don't think, unless you become an expert in the systems, you don't have a right to judge it or make the comparison unless you've actually completed it. And he didn't. And that way, I don't see eye to eye with him, you know? So, I do understand his philosophy around it, where you became rigid and became a stickler. But Koru martial arts is really about the idea that everything you will ever need is in that art. You don't have to go outside it to learn everything. And that's just not true. Because we live in different times in history. There are different tactical and technical innovations. And man himself changes. He becomes stronger, thinner, swifter. So, you know, we evolve as a human race. We evolve. I mean, look at the size of who we are today from the Middle Ages, for crying out loud.
Wow, even from the 1800s. Okay, yeah. I got another question from another person. They wanted me to ask you, what's the explanation behind the physics behind smashing a Jack Daniels bottle?
Well, what it is, you're creating a shockwave. What you're doing, and the shockwave is it's hard to describe, but it's actually a double strike. You don't see it because it's going so fast. But what it is, it's a transfer of pure kinetic energy, and you're using the pressure within the glass itself and the shock to become overcome the glass, and that's why the glass explodes. I don't smash the bottle. I actually cause it to explode on its own because it's just there's just not enough air, and you're crushing the air, and it's just forcing too much in it, and it just kind of comes out. But it's all based on sending a harmonic shockwave through it that causes it to just explode like it does. You can do something similar if you take a bottle of beer and you take off the cap. And I want to make people understand this. I had this thing with a cap on when I hit it. So, but you can do, to understand kind of what's going on, you can take it and you can fill it up all the way with water. And if you pop the top of it, sometimes you can get the bottom of the actual beer bottle to pop out because of the pressure. You understand?
Right. Yes, totally.
And but it's really also the transfer kinetic energy with the pressure at the bottom of the glass, got nowhere to go, and it just forces it to go at the weakest point. Okay? So that's what's really going on. But it's real skill. I mean, you've got to be hitting in a certain millisecond range, and you really got to know how to pull that energy, you know, out of your body. It's called fajing. The Japanese call it, you know, the Chinese call it fajing.
That's something a layman couldn't do that. That's something that has to be taught, correct?
Well, I was never taught it. I actually heard of the skill and observed how certain guys did it, and I read in how what they looked like when they did it, and I just kind of imitated that, and that's how I did it. Most of the stuff that I've ever done, I learned on my own. I was never taught it. I never was taught the bottom brick. I heard that ninjas could do that, and I really went down the same lane, training and duplicated the training, and I was able to train myself to do it. And that's another reason why I think Black Belt didn't want me there for many years, and I was, you know, hushed and not talked about because, you know, these guys who have schools and they're selling people, no, in order to really learn, you have to be in a school or you have to belong to an association. You can't be a free school of your own. You have to, you know, then you're not real. And it's like, what makes something real or not is the ability to perform, you know? You know, that's what I look at. You know, what makes you a healer? The ability to heal, not because you went to some medical school.
Correct. Correct. So tell us what's the Legion of Legacy about? How did that come about, and what is that exactly?
Oh, Legends and Legacies. Legends and Legacies was a project that I worked on with a guy named Gordon Rakusa. And what we did is we wanted to create a venue. And I'm still looking for people who want to cooperate with us and want to be part of it. It's a venue where people have an opportunity to tell their story in their own words, in their own way, without any interruption, without being edited, without somebody else getting in there and twisting and spinning it and using it, you know, for hype, so they can get high ratings or whatever. And then talk about anything. And, you know, if you've been accused of something, it's an opportunity to get in there and say, okay, this is what I was accused of, but here are the facts you aren't aware of. You know what I mean?
Right.
Here's my story. You know? And they tell their story. And it's quite remarkable, you know, what we have there. So.
Okay, and what's up with, and you have the fellowship that involves children. What's going on with that?
Well, I have a thing called the Frank Diggs Fellowship. What Frank Diggs Fellowship is it really embodies the spirit of what martial arts is supposed to be and watching out for those who can't take care of themselves. So one of the things we do is we mentor children. We put a program in place for like-minded martial artists, and we're just there to protect and advance these kids' lives. And that's it. And that sometimes it's just dropping off food. Sometimes it's being a big brother to them. Sometimes it's putting them in the schools and teaching them. Working with underprivileged kids and even overprivileged kids. You'd be surprised how many kids come from privilege, but they have no one mentoring them. No one is at home really raising them except the nanny, you know? So we're there for them, and that's what it's about.
Do you have these across the United States, or are they just in certain areas right now?
It's across the world. It's sort of like a secret society club. Anybody who wants to be a member of the fellowship, please feel free to get a hold of me, contact me. And you can do that through hanshifrankdukes@gmail.com. That's hanshifrankdukes@gmail.com. And we're a circle of iron. We're just people who encapsulate the warrior mentality of laying down our lives for our community and our families and to protect those who cannot protect themselves. And that's what it's about. That's what the fellowship's all about.
That's fantastic. That's powerful. And I think more of us should get involved with situations like that to try to give something back instead of take all the time.
Well, you end up getting far more back by giving than you'll ever take. You could ever take in life in a situation like that. Here's a personal anecdote on that. I had a kid who couldn't afford lessons at first, so I reduced my rate or whatever. And he would ride the bus from Hollywood with his mother. He was a little bit slow because he had a severe head injury as a child in an automobile accident. Nobody would really give him the time or the energy to. They get frustrated. To give you an idea, to learn a forward roll, it took him almost 2 years to perfect it. But when he did it, no one could do it better than him. This kid, his name is George Patiotis, later grew up to be a man. And one day I was complaining to George, saying, you know, George, I feel sick. I feel really sick. I just don't know how to describe it. And he's never in all those years ever heard me ever say that, where I actually said, hey, I may need some help. He immediately got in the car with another friend named Jose Bimides, who's a doctor now, by the way. And they got in the car with no brakes, came over the hill from the San Fernando Valley to my place in Santa Monica at that time. I was living in Santa Monica. And they found me collapsed on in my living room, barely holding on to life from spinal meningitis. They kicked in the door. Most people, when they didn't hear me answer, they would have gone away. He decided, George and them were concerned enough to say, you know what, I don't care what happens. Let's risk it. He kicked in the door. They saw me collapse. They called the paramedics. The paramedics came out. And because I was able to control, through my training, my vitals, my heart rate and everything else, they said, oh, there's nothing wrong with him. And George knew better. And he says, no, you don't understand. This guy's a real master. No, he looks okay. Why don't you guys drive him? He says, no, you're driving him to the hospital because either you have two choices. You could ride in the front seat with him in the gurney, or you can be in the gurney. Your choice. And he just pointed at the door. And they put me in the ambulance, and I was within 10 minutes of losing my life, is what the doctor said. That ride made all the difference in the world whether I lived or died. And it's because that kind of, like, giving back, if you will, caused enough for him to think enough of me to want to give back as well. And think about it. How many people would say, oh, we don't have a car to go to risk it? Well, we'll go in the morning. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
How many people would put that off, would find some excuse? And that's the benefit of the training. I always teach my students, do not procrastinate. Don't put things off, you know?
They wouldn't even have kicked in the door to see if you was in there or if you was all right. They just would have turned and walked away when you didn't answer.
You're right, and I would have been dead.
Yep, just that
I would have been dead. Yeah, and that's the benefit of the training people and knowing that. And I love them for it, you know. And it's interesting, after that experience, both became healthcare professionals, George and Jose. You know, which I always thought was rather interesting after that event, because I think they were moved by the fact that it saved my life, and that meant something to them. So,
well, that is, you know, powerful. That's not something everybody get to do every day.
No, no, and it was very, very powerful. And to even show you more power, George's mother, who's from the old country of Greece, she's Greek, they would come. I was in a coma from the meningitis. They would come to my hospital bed every day, and they made sure she would exercise my muscles every day, work my legs, my arms, every part of me while I was out cold. Imagine this. And if not for that reason, I would have been in a chair. My body would have atrophied. And it's not that the VA doesn't have people to do it. It's just they don't have enough people. That's why you have to have people there who care about you, who are going to be there to protect you. And it's even more interesting is show you karma-wise. When that was going on with me, they had a defect in the drip, you know, the plasma drips.
Yes.
That killed any number of veterans during that era. And luckily for me, I was sharing the room, show you how divine God is. I'm in a room with a guy who's an engineer who knew how to read that and who could detect when the machine wasn't working and would get up and fix it. In the middle of the night, he himself looking out for me, making sure I was okay. One veteran looking out for another.
Yeah, well, that is powerful. You did have a spirit riding with you.
Yeah, and I've had that all my life, and I've been very, very blessed. And I really mean that. There's so many incidences in my life where I should have perished or been destroyed by a set of circumstances, and it's more than just sheer luck. There's just the hand of God, if you want to call it, on me to protect me. And so much so that, well, I remember one day that I was questioning, you know, how do I know you're there, that kind of thing. And the next day, I mean, that night I had a dream. And then the dream was based on a story I'd heard in the Marine Corps about a guy who this preacher was talking about. I went to a Protestant service, believe it or not, being Jewish, regardless. And the minister there was talking about how there was a story of a guy who was on top of a hill and the wind blew him off and he fell and he was able to grab onto a limb jutting out from the cliffside with hundreds of feet down below him to where if he let go, he would die. And then he heard a spiritual voice telling him, you know, this is, you know, I'm your God and I'm the one who blew you over, the wind who blew you over, and if you let go, I'll blow you back up. And that was like a test of faith. That's the way this minister was talking about what is the meaning of faith? You know, and so that was chilling in my head. And I went to bed that night, and I had the dream that tomorrow I'm going to throw you off a mountain, and you're going to know I exist. And don't worry, nothing's going to happen to you. And sure enough, this is a funny thing. Of all the days, I put on my Hubie Kearns Stunt School T-shirt, go up to the Zuma Rocks, tie off. I'd done rappelling there years and years, without incident. And that day, the line gave way.
Wow.
And, okay, there's no line. I had just kicked off, and I'm coming down the side of the mountain. And if you know Zuma Cliff, there's nothing but one small patch of sand and everything else around it is sharp rocks. And I happen to land, and this is what's so weird, feet first, on the sand, fell just back on my ass, rolled up, and nothing happened to me. And people saw it all around me, and they saw my shirt and thought, oh, that was some kind of stunt, you know? That I practiced. And I got all these congratulations on this fantastic stunt I did. And I'm going, that was no stunt. And that's just one testimony of things that happened in my life that are just go defy all odds, that lets me know, hey, you know what? Try to walk beyond yourself. Try to look beyond yourself and think of everyone else's, you know, the child of God, if you will, and that's your brother, your sister. You all share that common existence. We all want the same thing, and that's to be loved, you know?
Right. What would you say?
We all want.
What would you say, Frank, would be one of your proudest accomplishments?
One of my proudest accomplishments would probably be finding love and getting married here soon. That would be one of them. I'm getting married here in November, so I'm very proud of that.
Okay. Well, I assume by that statement, this is your first rodeo as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, I could say that.
Okay, well, I'll leave that alone.
We won't go too far for that.
Okay, listen. No. Okay, we'll keep it moving. Well, what's in store next for you? What do you see in your near future? What you got going on next?
Oh, I want to work on building the fellowship up, getting more people involved. I've got a book I call The Martial Art Bible, Secrets of Warriorship, where I've actually codified all the movements in the martial arts. And if you follow this book, believe it or not, you'll be able to become a grandmaster. It's there. I wanted to give it and create it for the guy who's out like in a village in the middle of Mexico who can't find a grandmaster, but this way he put the information in his hands where he can learn and actually by himself grow, you know, share the information. And also raise the level of martial arts to a level of professionalism that's lacking today. I also want to correct a lot of wrongs. That's why I wrote this book, Ninjas Are Bullshit, and put people on track of what's really going on and what they should be doing and as far as how they view the martial arts and what is a martial art. I mean, I talk to most people and they don't understand when I say ninjutsu is not a martial art, and they say, how can you say that? And I don't know how much time we have, but basically, to be a martial art, you have to have three components: tension, tension, and kinshin. And what it is basically you have to have a spiritual component of how you, when you do a technique, the essence of how it goes, whether it's hard or soft, if you want to call it technique. The other one is the aspect of the body biomechanics that has specific body biomechanics. And the last thing is that you can sum up the style or the system in one phrase, one haku. And so, you know, jiu-jitsu, the gentle way, you know what I mean? Things like that.
Is it available now, or when will it be available?
I'm hoping to have it available by the end of the year. I just have so much going on, maybe the middle of next year, only because I'm getting married, you know, so I've had to take a back step to a lot of my projects and do things like that. But we've got that going, and that's really powerful, and I hope people will enjoy that as far as the martial arts goes.
Well, definitely congratulations early on the
Thank you.
Long, successful, happy marriage and all that. And if you come through Los Angeles, definitely look us up. We're glad to take you guys out for dinner or something.
Well, I'm in Los Angeles now, by the way. I've actually moved back.
Oh, fantastic. Well, definitely. We definitely have to get together and talk to you about the other portion of this interview, the TV show.
Sure.
And I definitely want to thank you for taking time out to come through and holler at us. I know you're very busy. Also, do you have any movies, any other things lined up in the near future, anything like that?
Yes, I do. I have a movie that I worked on. In fact, George Bush came out to the set when he was president. It's been a long, exhausting work of love. It's called No Right to Die, and we're still fixing it up and getting the color correction. It's a epic picture on Genghis Khan, and it was all filmed in Mongolia using authentic costumes, all done in Mongolian, and just a 100% Mongolian production, really. So it represents the first time the Mongolian people tell the story of their national hero in their own way.
Now that sounds awesome. You know, I definitely enjoyed, you know, Genghis Khan's story and the archery. I've always been a fan of archery.
And that's another thing I'm getting involved in is actually have a Dukeshu archery for the U.S. Archery Association. So that's another thing we're doing.
Okay. Well, that's great. And again, Frank, I definitely want to thank you for coming join us in the ring. And before you go, throw your contact information out there so people can get in contact with
sure.
you as far as fellowship.
Sure. My contact information is just best way is through email is through Hanshi Frank Dukes. That's HanshiFrankDux@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook, but I got to warn you, there's 47 impersonators. Look for the one where it's a picture of me on Warrior Magazine, and it's Frank W. Dukes on Facebook. If you want to check out what's happening with me, or the real Frank Dukes, that's another Facebook page of mine. But the best thing is just get a hold of me through my email, and again, HanshiFrankDukes@gmail.com, HanshiFrankDux@gmail.com. You can also look up www.frankwdukes, and that's D-U-X, of course, .com. That's kind of an information hub that may help people if they're more interested in what I'm doing.
Fantastic. And also I want to give a shout-out to Brenda Hollenbeck and also to Lisa King.
Awesome.
Well, Frank, definitely good luck on your marriage, and hopefully before you leave the city, we'll get together and be able to meet personally and all that good stuff. And
I'd like that. That would be great.
And awesome. Awesome, man. It's definitely been a pleasure to have you on the show. I've always been a fan of yours. I'd definitely like to talk to you a little bit more about the philosophy of the arts and stuff.
Sure. It'd be my pleasure.
So, you know, once you get situated and come back off your honeymoon, you know, if you have some energy, hopefully I can get you back on the show.
Right, survive it, you mean.
Yeah, as I said, if you have some energy.
She's,
now.
She's young and beautiful.
Well, I know she got to be beautiful, and she definitely got to know her stuff, boy, to keep you in check.
Oh, yeah, she definitely does. She's a Texas girl.
Definitely, man. On behalf of all of us over here, man, thank you so much, man. We enjoyed you, man. And you be safe out there.
All right, you too. Bye.
All right, thank you. Mr. Frank Dukes, everybody. Mr. Frank Dukes, World Heavyweight Kumite Champion. Let everybody know you heard it right here on In the Ring. We will definitely continue to bring you the best and the most exciting fighters, MMA fighters, martial artists, anything that goes on in the ring. And you heard it right here with your host, Lamont Patterson, your host, and our associate, Ms. Jan Honore, who helped produce this event and make this show happen today. Y'all come back next week and see us right here in the ring. Out, y'all.